Thank you, Todd. Thanks for having me.
In your book, you draw a distinction between the Jesus of the New Testament Gospels and the Jesus of the historical sources. What's the difference there?
Well, I guess the easiest way to put it is that the Jesus of the New Testament, the Christ of faith, as he's often referred to, is a Christian and is preaching Christianity. And the Jesus of history was a Jew preaching Judaism. Now, I know that that sounds odd and in some ways even perhaps obvious, but there is a distinction. The followers of Jesus, the disciples, and Jesus's early community would have understood his message as a deeply Jewish message, primarily intended for other Jews. The writers of the Gospels, who were, of course, writing much later, much after Jesus' death, had already transformed this movement into a wholly new religion. And so what they were preaching was a new idea that was not just different from Judaism, but in some ways even divorced from it.
Why did they do that? Why did the authors of the New Testament Gospels transform what you call the historical Jesus into the Jesus of faith?
Well, because they had the faith to do so. I mean, however you feel about Jesus, whether you believe that he's God incarnate or just a man, or whether you feel that he didn't exist at all, whatever the case may be, what you cannot deny is that after Jesus' death, his followers had what they claimed to be an ecstatic experience, an experience that propelled them to transform the very nature and message of Jesus. You see, the problem with the Jewish Messiah, as Jesus would have referred to himself, the problem with the Jewish Messiah is that the primary function of the Messiah is to recreate the kingdom of David on earth. If you're walking around first century Palestine and you're claiming to be the Messiah, every Jew who heard you say that would assume that what you mean is that you're here to usher in the reign of God to reestablish David's kingdom. Well, if you die without doing that, well, then you're not the Messiah. And in fact, there were countless people in Jesus' time who were making quite similar claims as Jesus, healing the sick, performing miracles, talking about the kingdom of God, gathering disciples, calling themselves the Messiah. And to a person, they were all killed for that ambition. And when they were killed, their disciples simply abandoned the movement, but Jesus' disciples did not. Instead, they redefined the very concept of Messiah, sort of removed its Jewish connotation and transformed it into the kind of celestial spirit that most Christians think of when they think of the word Messiah.
So are you saying that the authors of the New Testament Gospels essentially not only recast certain information about Jesus, the historical Jesus, into a new conception of a messianic kingdom, but in fact made some stuff up in order to bolster that conception?
See, this is the problem with the modern mind, is that we think that there is a difference between, we think that fact and truth are the same thing. We are predicated upon this modern conception of history as an accumulation of empirically verifiable facts and figures. The ancient mind did not think that way about history. So it's a mistake to say that the gospel writers, quote unquote, made stuff up. The gospels are not, nor were they ever intended to be read as what you and I refer to as history. These are not eyewitness events of things that happen. These are testimonies of faith written many years after the events that they describe by communities of faith. I guess the easiest way to put it is that the gospel writers already believed something about Jesus, that he was the Son of God or God incarnate, and then they wrote their gospels to prove that belief. What you and I think of when we think of history would have made no sense to the gospel writers. The purpose of the gospels was not to reveal specific facts about Jesus. It was to reveal truths about Jesus that the gospel writers already believed. Now, what that means is that the gospel is filled with both historical and mystical information, and the job of the modern biblical scholar is to figure out which is which. And that's a process that's been underway for almost 200 years now, actually, in biblical studies.
I just want to come to one thing that is, at least on the face of it, in reading the New Testament Gospels, presented as fact. And it sounds like you're saying no. They were simply presenting it as a truth that they believed, the resurrection of Jesus. The crucifixion is not in question here, I assume, but all four Gospels do attest to, in one form or another, an empty tomb and the resurrection
right.
of Jesus. Are you saying that that was simply trying to convey a truth about Jesus and not a fact that he actually rose from the dead? That they are not asserting that Jesus actually was alive after 3 days after being crucified?
No. When it comes to the resurrection, that's a tricky subject for the historian. I write in my book that, by definition, the resurrection is an ahistorical event, and so therefore historians have no business commenting upon it. But what is a historical fact is the claim to the resurrection. So let me just be clear one more time. The historian cannot talk about whether the resurrection, quote-unquote, happened or not, because that's a matter of faith. It's outside the bounds of history. What we can talk about is the undeniable fact that very soon after Jesus' death, within 2 or 3 or 4 years, the belief in his resurrection had already become firmly embedded in the doctrine of this movement. Now, what does that mean? Well, who knows? I mean, if you're a believer, you say, well, that's because he actually rose from the dead. If you're a non-believer, then you'd say, well, that's because they were fooled, or it was some sort of, you know, mass psychosis, or the body was stolen, or whatever the case may be. That's a question of faith, and the historian has no business answering questions of faith. But what I can tell you is that, like it or not, the belief in the resurrection seems to have been a very, very early one, earlier than the virgin birth, earlier than the nativity stories, earlier than even the resurrection stories themselves. That's really interesting. The stories about the resurrection appear much, much later, not really until the end of the first century, but belief in the resurrection starts almost right after Jesus' death, and you just take that for what you want.
No, it is, to be fair, outside the purview of your book, but Paul, writing to the Corinthians very early, in fact.
Very early, that's right.
1 Corinthians 15 would be the reference, I think, refers to the factual nature of Jesus' resurrection as the sine qua non of essentially all the Christian faith. He says, look,
that's right.
If Christ is not raised, just forget about the rest of everything I've told you. How do you account for that? Because he seems to deal with it as something that he believes actually occurred, and if it did not actually occur, then, as he says, our faith is in vain, our belief is in vain. How do you account for that?
What do you mean, how do I account for that historically?
Well, the fact that Paul, writing very early, didn't believe that he was just conveying a truth
but Corinthians was probably written anytime between the years 48 to 50. Jesus died sometime between, you know, 30 and 35 is the best guess that we can give. And so what's interesting is when Paul is writing that statement in Corinthians in the year 48, what he is doing is actually repeating a liturgical formula, which means that the belief was much, much earlier than 48. So most scholars would say that probably by the end of the 30s, the beginning of the 40s, not only was resurrection a widely believed phenomenon among the early Christians, but that it had already embedded itself as one of the core tenets of this movement. And that's what Paul is reflecting. And so that's precisely what I mean to say, is that this is one of those kind of tricky things for historians. For years, by the way, I should mention, for years in historical Jesus studies, it was assumed that the belief in the resurrection was very, very late. Because, as I say, the stories of the resurrection, which appear in do not appear in the Gospel of Mark, written around 70. First time that they appear is in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, written between 90 and 100 or so. The stories of the resurrection are late, so people assumed that the belief in the resurrection was late. But now we know that belief in the resurrection was an early, early phenomenon. And frankly, historians don't know what to do with that. They just throw their hands up in the air and say, well, I guess something must have happened.
But Paul, you would concede that Paul believed, to come back to your distinction between fact and truth, he believed in the fact of the resurrection, not merely a truth regarding the resurrection.
Yes, but see, again, I think what you're misunderstanding is the difference between myth and fact in the gospel. So in other words, the belief in the resurrection, the fact that Jesus rose from the dead, is something that the early Christian community would have accepted as fact. The stories about Jesus's resurrection, the stories about, you know, him walking along with disciples who don't recognize him until he finally breaks bread with them, and then they recognize him, the stories of him showing up in front of 5,000 people, the story of him showing up where the disciples are hiding out and doubting Thomas, wanting to put his hand in his wounds, those are myths. That's what I'm trying to explain to you. Each one of those stories is a myth whose facts are not important, but whose truth, the truth that they reveal, are what's important. And the truth that they reveal are quite obvious. People were saying, well, you probably saw a ghost. Well, does a ghost eat fish and bread? No. So therefore, that's the story that proves that Jesus wasn't a ghost. People said, you know, well, his body was stolen. Well, Matthew takes care of that charge by placing guards outside of Jesus's tomb. Were there actually guards outside of Jesus's tomb? No, that's a myth that the purpose of which is to express a truth, which is that Jesus' body wasn't stolen. But the belief in the resurrection is a part of the liturgical formula. So what I'm saying is that the resurrection is a matter of belief. And what you and I were talking about earlier is the difference in the Gospels, when you read the stories of the Gospels, between fact and mythology, fact and truth.
What was Jesus' conception of himself and of his quote-unquote ministry?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. We know we can be fairly confident about what the disciples thought Jesus was. We can be fairly confident about what the Romans thought Jesus was. We can be fairly confident about, you know, the various ways in which the early church viewed Jesus. But when it comes to Jesus' self-consciousness, then we're just kind of shooting in the dark. I guess, really, the way to think about it is, what did Jesus call himself? That's the question that you have to answer before you can think about what did Jesus think of himself. Scholars are fairly unanimous about the fact that Jesus probably did not call himself the Son of God. Now, I think it's important to understand that Son of God in Judaism is not a description, it's a title. Many, many people are called Son of God in the Bible, none more often than, of course, King David. Son of God is a title for kings. So in other words, if Jesus actually called himself Son of God, and he very likely did not, but if he did call himself Son of God, he meant he was king. That's what everyone would have understood Son of God to mean, because that's all it means in Judaism. It is only among the Greeks and the Romans that Son of God indicates some sort of filial relationship with God. For instance, Caesar was the Son of God. Probably, and again, I'm just talking about sort of the majority consensus among scholars, the most common belief among biblical scholars is that Jesus referred to himself as Son of Man. Now, the problem, of course, is that while there is fair consensus that that's what Jesus called himself, there's almost no consensus about what he actually meant when he said Son of Man. Some scholars believe that Son of Man in its Hebrew idiom is just another word for man. It's just a byword for man. But most scholars think that when Jesus called himself Son of Man, he was referencing a prophecy of Daniel, in which he sees the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven to judge all of humanity. And so probably by Jesus' time, Son of Man was Jesus' cryptic way of referring to himself as the Messiah. Now, why cryptic? Because Jesus was not a fool. I mean, from from the time that Jesus is born to the time that the Temple of Jerusalem is destroyed in the year 70, so in that 70 years, at the very least, 13 other messiahs arose, and every single one of those messiahs was killed, because if you're a Jew who says you're the Messiah, then what you are saying is that you are here to reestablish the kingdom of David and to usher in the reign of God. Well, if you're here to usher in the reign of God, then that means you're here to usher out the reign of Caesar, and that is a treasonable offense. And so every claimant to the Messiah, including Jesus, was killed for the claim. So I guess what I would say is that Jesus thought that he was the Messiah, but when he said Messiah, he meant probably what every Jew meant when he said Messiah, the descendant of King David, here to usher in the kingdom of God. But, of course, he didn't do that. He was as successful in doing what the Messiah was supposed to do as all the other so-called false messiahs, and that's where we get to where we started this conversation, which is that confronted with the fact that Jesus didn't do what the Messiah was supposed to do, the disciples had two choices. Either he wasn't the Messiah, or what we think the Messiah is incorrect, that the Messiah means something else, and they chose the latter.
Now, did Jesus anticipate his death in any terms other than, well, if I keep going this direction, the Romans will probably kill me? Did he anticipate his death as anything more meaningful than just another zealot dying at the hands of the Roman occupiers?
Well, here's how I would answer that question as a historian. Jesus' entire ministry was maybe, 24 months, I suppose, 24, 28 months, less than 3 years. 99% of that ministry, indeed, every minute of his ministry except for the last few days of it, was spent not just in Galilee, but in the backwoods of Galilee, in the small towns, the small villages. He assiduously avoided big cities, and he absolutely avoided Judea, and almost treated Jerusalem like it was, the plague. I mean, he stayed as far from Jerusalem as he possibly could, and no wonder. But the interesting thing is, it seems as though during that ministry in the Galilee, he wasn't what we would refer to as successful. The Gospel of Luke says that he had 72 disciples. Well, I mean, we know a lot about the other messiahs. One of them, the Egyptian, had 4,000 disciples. So it seems as though, either by design or just, by happenstance, his decision to maintain his ministry among the poor, the marginalized, the dispossessed of Galilee kept him more or less out of the attention of the priestly and Roman authorities. And then one day, out of the blue, for reasons that we can only guess, he says to his disciples, "Let's go to Jerusalem." And not only does he say, "Let's go to Jerusalem," but he decides to enter Jerusalem in about the most provocative way possible. He declares himself king in that triumphal entry into Jerusalem when he's riding on a donkey, the way that the prophet Zechariah says that the king shall enter Jerusalem. He takes part in this dramatically violent act in the temple, which would have been instantly punishable by death. In other words, it's almost as though he is courting his own death. It's almost as though he is deliberately trying to get the attention of the authorities who more or less have ignored him up to this point. Now, if you're a Christian, what you would say is that he's doing that because it was his plan all along to be crucified, that it was a cosmic agenda and this was part of it. That's a perfectly fine view. But as a historian, you have to stop and think about what is the motivation for that, to really say to the disciples, "Let's go kill ourselves," is what you're saying in the actions of his final days. And to me, because I myself do not believe that Jesus was the incarnate God. I respect those people who do, but I don't believe that he was. And so I have to look to his human motivations for that. And what I think that he is doing is recognizing that without, you know, his death, without this sort of dramatic expression of his values, his identity, at the heart of the beast, right at the temple where both Rome and the priestly authorities, his two greatest enemies, reside, was a way for him to make sure that his ministry, that his teachings actually matter, that people hear it, that his fight for the poor and the dispossessed and the marginalized is something that has to be confronted by the authorities themselves. So to me, his human motivation, to be perfectly frank, is much more laudable, I think, you know, about a man who is willingly sacrificing himself on behalf of, you know, the poor and the marginalized and the beliefs about the new world system that he holds. To me, as a human being, is much more, I think, inspirational than sort of the Christian theological view that this is all some grand design and that Jesus as God was just simply fulfilling a plan that was written in the stars.
What kind of objective criteria do you employ when looking at the sources to distinguish between, as you say, kind of the mix of history and mythology in the New Testament Gospels? How do you decide?
That's a very good question. The sort of the tools of scriptural exegesis, as I was saying before, the tools that allow us to, as best as possible, separate myth from history, myth from fact, from the Gospels, have been in place for some 200 years. It's a very complex process. It involves things like multiple attestations, things that sort of stick out like a sore thumb, ironically, tend to be more likely historical. It has also to do with dating. So, for instance, scholars will tend to put greater weight to the Gospel of Mark, which was written, you know, first sometime around the early 70s, than they would to, say, the Gospel of John, which was written between 100 and 120 AD, so much, much later. But if I were to put it in its simplest way possible, it would be this. Although we know very little about the historical Jesus himself, we know a lot about the world in which he lived. First century Palestine is an era that was very well documented, thanks to the Romans, who were, if anything, adept at documentation. So we know a lot about Jesus's world. What we do is we take the claims of the Gospels and we analyze them according to what we know about the history of the time and place that Jesus lived. And if they match, then they're more likely to be historically accurate, and if they don't, then they're not. I suppose, you know, let me just give you one example of this, for instance. So the story of Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. The Gospel of Luke says that there is a census in the year 6 AD of the entire Roman world, that Jesus is, like every subject of Rome, forced to uproot himself from Jesus's parents, I should say, like every Roman subject is forced to uproot himself from his home in Nazareth and travel to Bethlehem, the place of his father's birth, in order to be counted, and that's why he's born in Bethlehem. Well, again, the Romans are very good at documentation, particularly when it comes to taxation, which is the purpose of census, and that's just simply incorrect. First of all, there was a census in 6 AD, but it wasn't of the entire Roman world. It was just of Judea, Idumea, and Perea. So it didn't even count Galilee, which is where Jesus lived, so it wouldn't have affected him in the slightest. And secondly, we know for a fact that Roman law did not require people, the subject citizens, to uproot themselves from the place where they lived and where their property was, which is the whole point of being counted, is to count your property, and travel great distances to the place of your father. That just simply did not happen. Here's the important thing that I want to make. The point that I want to make is that Luke knew that story was factually incorrect. He was still a Roman citizen living under Roman law. His readers knew that story is factually incorrect. They were Roman citizens living under Roman law. They didn't care because they understood that what they were reading was an issue that involved truth, not fact. The facts didn't matter. It's the truth that mattered. And what is the truth? The truth is that Jesus is born in the city of David, and therefore he is the legitimate descendant of David, the Messiah. Does that make sense?
Why? Well, I'm curious. Why discount, it would seem almost a priori, discount the four Gospels as honest historical eyewitness accounts, laying aside your contention that they're written late? Why discount them?
That's just historical fact. And I'm not sure what you mean by why discount it, because they're not. They're not eyewitness accounts. That's why I say
a priori.
Because it's a fact. I mean, they were written. That we know when the Gospel of Mark was written. We know when the Gospel of Matthew and Luke were written. We know where they were written. And so they were written many years after Jesus' death. So it's not a matter of just an a priori discounting. It's just simply a matter of historical fact. If you come after events, they're not eyewitness accounts. It's as simple as that.
Why not? Why discount them as history that is rather proximate to the events they claim to? I mean, to say that if you write 100 years after an event, you're not going to get it right a priori, or you're going to distort it in some way.
Oh, no, that's not what I said at all. What I said was, of the many, many tools at our disposal to figure out what is more likely historically accurate and what is less likely historically accurate, one of those tools is that if it was written earlier, we tend to give it more weight than if it was written later. So in other words, when it comes to, you know, something that Mark says, so for instance, Mark says that among the final acts of Jesus is the triumphant entry into Jerusalem. John says the very first thing that Jesus does is his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Well, that's a contradiction. Which one is correct? Most scholars will look at that and say, we'll accept Mark because he was written earlier. That's all.
So what you're simply saying here is, based upon what 19th and 20th century biblical scholarship asserts about the original dates of the writings,
mm-hmm.
we're gonna set them later. We're going to put them on a sliding scale. Earlier is more accurate. Later is less accurate. And then we're going to take...
Often that is the case, yes.
Then we're going to take what we know from Roman history and kind of push the four Gospels through that sieve and see what comes out on the other side.
That's exactly right. Yes, you summed it up perfectly.
Why wouldn't we do this with any other ancient documents that purport to record history?
We do, as a matter of fact. So I'll give you one example. Concurrent with the writing of the Gospels is the work of a great Jewish historian and Roman citizen by the name of Flavius Josephus. Josephus, in the end of the first century, wrote a massive history of the Jews, and then a second history of the Jewish war that ultimately resulted in the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70. Now, Jerusalem, Josephus is not, you know, writing about gods or messiahs. He's not a theologian. He's not making, you know, faith statements at all. He's trying as hard as possible to just simply tell an accurate story. He calls himself a historian. But even so, we know that a lot of the claims that Josephus makes do not actually match what we know about the history of the time. And we realize that, of course, Josephus is writing his history for the Emperor Titus, the man who actually destroyed Jerusalem. So, for instance, we know that Titus and his troops deliberately burned Jerusalem to the ground, deliberately razed the temple in Jerusalem as punishment for the Jewish revolt. Josephus says, oh no, it was an accident, and Titus did everything in his power to try to, put out the fire, it was not his fault that the city and the temple of God burned to the ground. Well, obviously that's not true. I mean, obviously he is saying that because he wants to ingratiate himself to his benefactor. So we do that with everything. We do that with all ancient texts because, And I need to just emphasize this one more time so that, because it seems it's a very difficult thing to, for the modern mind to understand. Because what you and I call history is wholly a product of the modern world. What you and I define to be history, the accumulation of facts and figures and dates, is barely 300 years old. That the that definition of history would have been wholly foreign to the ancient mind, whether they are the gospel writers or whether they are Herodotus or whether they are Philo the Elder or whether they are Josephus.
Dr. Reza Aslan is Associate Professor of Creative Writing and Cooperative Faculty Member in the Department of Religion at the University of California, Riverside, and he's author of a number one New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Dr. Aslan, thank you very much for your time.
It was my pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thanks, Todd.